Ghosts. Have they become a cliché? Or can we once again examine this phenomena seriously? After all, isn't it really our own afterlife we're curious about? Let's delve a little deeper on Jim Harold's Ghost Insight. Welcome to Ghost Insight. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you once again. And I think we have quite a treat for you because we're going to talk about the curse of El Diablo, sorcery, miracles, and black magic in northern Mexico, and other topics, lighthearted topics like that. And our guest today is the author, you heard her just there, Sonia Brose. She is a Maronite Catholic, a charismatic, a visionary, and spiritual warrior called 44 years ago to the service of God in the field of exorcism and deliverance. With over 40 years of training and acquired knowledge in metaphysics, witchcraft, magic, and sorcery of all cultures and religions of the world, she's been an active consultant and advisor to exorcists of the Catholic Church, as well as deliverance pastors and ministers of all faiths for over 30 years. And Sonia Brose is our guest and author of the book, and we're so glad to have her with us today. Sonia, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Jim. I appreciate you having me on.
I want to go back to something in your bio before we get into the curse of El Diablo. You talk about the field of exorcism and deliverance. Now, almost everybody listening is familiar with exorcism, even if it's just the references in the pop culture. But deliverance, explain to us what deliverance means.
Well, deliverance is really helping someone free themselves from oppression. Oppression doesn't normally require an exorcism. Oppression is where you get an attachment, or either a demonic attachment or even some other type of spiritual attachment that really robs you of your quality of life. So it is, it's a real burden for a lot of people, and it really does damage their lifestyle and how they want to live. A heavy oppression or oppression itself is really where people just start to have problems with their thinking, with maybe their homes, a lot of activity going on, but that's accompanied by a lot of personal angst and concern. They may hear sounds again and again. They might have be touched, poked, prodded, pushed downstairs. They might have objects moving around in their home, just flying past their faces, all kinds of things. This is kind of where they see things like the black mist in the room, or feel like they're constantly being followed. But it has an effect mentally as well. So thoughts can be projected into their heads that they just normally would not think or say or even consider themselves. Really more of a foreign type of a incursion into their consciousness and their life. So deliverance is a really important part of the entire process, because before someone can be possessed, you know, you really can't be possessed unless you give your consent to a demonic entity. Oppression is how they wear people down to where they just literally give up. They alienate them from other people. Nobody wants to be, you don't want to be the topic of conversation at your holiday dinner, hey, Joe, how's it going? Now you still got pianos flying by you in the room, you still seeing things, hearing stuff, everything. Nobody wants to show up to your house. When you try to talk to people about it, they treat you like you're crazy. And even some of the clergy, some of the clergy here, they can be very concerned. They don't really know what's going on. There's a lot of clergy that are actually pretty ignorant, really, of oppression and how it actually works and what happens. So you don't always find understanding there either. So you might be handed your hat,
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're certainly in the field. I talk to people from time to time from maybe the New Age side of the fence, and they're very nice people, and they have a lot of good points. But sometimes they will say, well, there's no such thing as evil. There's kind of like different levels of spiritual evolution. And I kind of have used this example many times. I know you've been a listener to the program, so you may have heard me say, is that, well, okay, what about Adolf Hitler? What about John Wayne Gacy? What about Jeffrey Dahmer? You know, I respect those people, not those people, but the New Age folks, but I disagree. I think there is evil. I'm assuming you think there's evil too.
Oh, I know there's evil, Jim. You know, this is a thing so far. Those that say they don't believe in evil, perhaps they're more or less addressing the demonic aspect of evil. You know, we all know that there are evil men, there are evil acts, there are evil things that happen. But, you know, a lot of times people don't believe in the devil. They don't believe that the devil's actually active. And I can honestly tell you that, you know, when I walk into a house where there's serious oppression, the emanation of evil in that house is overwhelming. For those people that say they don't believe in evil, I just say, hey, just walk into a house where an actual demon is, because if you're not convinced there's actual evil, then that demon simply hid from you. Because the evil itself that emanates from demonic entities is overwhelming. It's just the worst of the worst. You know, it's like, it's so, we can't relate to it. You know, you can only relate to what is actually in you. So if you're not a person that thinks in an evil way, that is evil yourself, it's very difficult for you to relate to evil. The presence or the energy of evil can literally drive people outside. It can just drive you right out the door running. That doesn't mean you actually understand it. And so, you know, I understand a lot of people that say, well, I don't believe in actual evil, but I beg to differ, because, you know, whether you can relate to it or not, you know that there is something there that wants you dead, or it just hates without cause, without reason. The level and depth of hatred is just incredible. It's just literally overwhelming. And if you don't recognize that as evil, then I don't know what word you would use for that. But it's certainly not a natural thing from the earth. It's not natural even in people. It drives people to evil acts. It can drive people to evil behavior, to saying evil things and rotten things and perpetrating things like Jeffrey Dahmer and his killing spree Adolf Hitler and people like that. It can certainly influence these people. Were they possessed? I don't know. I didn't know them. But, you know, could they have been possessed? Well, possibly, but you know, here's the thing. When someone is truly possessed, they're really quite incapable of acting like a regular person. They just literally are at the under control of the demonic presence. So could Jeffrey Dahmer have been perhaps under the control of the devil himself? That's a possibility. I don't know how much interaction he actually was able to do by his own choices. So the level of possession can also determine whether or not someone's actually possessed, whether they're just fully evil.
How do you fight something like this? I mean, if you're, and I do want to talk about the book, but if you're confronted with something like this, how in the world do you combat it?
The only way that I know of to combat it effectively, and believe me, I mean, I've been actually doing this for 44 years now, but is truly with my faith. I cannot possibly combat it on a personal, intellectual level or physical level without my faith, without the weapons of God, without the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. I can't possibly combat it. If I'm trying to combat it on my own, I could literally be ripped limb from limb. And there have been people who have been severely injured and killed by by demonic entities, even priests, ministers, pastors that were trying to combat the situation. It's one of these situations where you have to be absolutely precise. You're the details of what you do and how you do it have to be done very properly. So you have to be so secure in your faith. You have to have such a strong faith when you walk through that door that you cannot be dissuaded from your faith. My way of doing that is to literally set myself aside into the heart of Christ and step forward, knowing that Jesus will protect me, knowing that the triune God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit will protect me. And the saints, Saint Michael, Our Lady of Fatima, who is my patron saint. And, you know, without the weapons, without the exercised oil and water and salt, without the rosary, without the sacramentals that were given by the church, and these are not really Catholic things. These are biblical, gospel, apostolic things, and you see oil, salt, and water being used all the way through the Bible, and they were first used by the Hebrew people after Jesus Christ was crucified. The early churches that turned from the Jewish faith to the Christian faith, they developed rites of exorcism. And each one of these small churches, they tried to confer among each other, but if they were caught in a situation by themselves, they just simply had to learn how to do it. And, you know, the apostles helped them. Of course, the apostles had such strong faith that they were able to just command these demons out without much problem. But fasting and prayer, when you get to the hierarchy of demons, they are seraphim. Lucifer was a seraphim, which is the highest order. You have to be very, very clear with yourself and God. You've got to confess all your sins to Him, whether you're a Catholic or a Protestant or whatever. You've got to be a person of virtue and moral strength. You really do. And you have to look at the fasting and prayer required, because to try to stand up underneath that type of evil coming at you, it's just impossible. If you've got anything out there of your own that is just not copacetic, that hasn't been confessed, or anything that you're just holding back or whatever. So, you know, it's a very difficult process. And the early church fathers, this is one of the reasons the creed came into being, was the fact that after Jesus was born, the devil immediately had other men named Jesus born in Bethlehem and in Nazareth and all of this. And so they had to make sure that they were calling on the right Jesus or whatever in the rite. They had to literally identify him as being this Jesus that was crucified, dead, and buried. He was tried by Pontius Pilate. All of this, they had to go through the whole creed in doing an exorcism, just to be specific. You know, you can't leave any details. You can't assume the devil's going to play with you. He's not going to interpret what you're saying. He will interpret it the way he wants to, unless you are extremely specific. So having spent a lot of time with very formal exorcists, I can tell you that no exorcism is ever taken for granted as far as it being an easy task. It's just not.
Now, let's talk a little bit about The Curse of El Diablo. What inspired you to do this book?
Well, 20 years. It took me 20 years, Jim, to write the book. It was a situation in 1996 that I found myself brought into by a pastor friend of mine who had gone to Mexico and run into a situation where there was incredible witchcraft involved, but way beyond witchcraft. It was much more like the Castaneda men of knowledge type brujos and brujas and things. It was so beyond anything he knew prior that he called me and asked me to help him, because I've really made it a large part of my life has been a study of Latin American magic and the all of the practices, different practices of the different types of Latin American magic. And you know, I had also studied with many different shaman, whether they were in Mexico, Sonora Desert, or down as far as Peru. And I'd spent many, many years doing that. So Islander magic and Latin American magic, South American magic are really my forte. And so he called me in to help him back off the situation that was threatening this entire family. And that's how I got involved in it.
Can you tell us a little bit about this family that was kind of under siege?
Yes, they were really an incredible family, very strong in their faith, wonderful people, absolutely excellent, wonderful people. He was not the eldest son. I think probably the next to youngest son in the family was a doctor, just a renowned doctor, formal MD and brujo, who had built a large clinic down south of Juarez. It was west of Villa Humafa, and it was called the Clinica de Esperanza, or Clinic of Hope, and it was probably the first Clinica de Esperanza, but I'm not positive about that. But he had built this clinic because he had these holistic, not only the holistic aspects of healing, but also the regular medicine as well. He was, he had studied in the School of Medicine in Mexico City and in Cuba. And so he was very, very, he had high certifications and very legitimate man. He was also a world-class choreographer who took the dance troupe, Mexican dancers, around the world. Very well educated, very, very aristocratic. The entire family was very aristocratic, well known in politics and different aspects in Mexico. So what happened was that his best friend was also a renowned doctor. They'd gone to school together. They were friends for most of their lives. And they had entered into the training of brujo, to be brujo and to also be men of knowledge together. And they had studied for many, many years. They were both highly gifted in this and trained, well trained. They studied magic basically all over the world, both of them. So at one point, the good doctor, well, let's say good doctor, they were both good doctors, but let's just say Francisco was the man who built the clinic. And he, at one point, realized that his life was being taken over by the dark side. He really had a problem with it, and the Tarahumara Indians helped him to exorcise him from this demonic control. He was not possessed fully, but he was, nevertheless, he was partially possessed, and he was having a problem. So they did this exorcism, they and their priest, the regular priest, Catholic priest, down in Copper Canyon. And at that point, he decided to turn his life over to God, and he walked the way of St. James in Spain, and he earned his sword that's dedicated to St. Michael, and he became a real champion for God. So he dedicated, that's when he dedicated his clinic to God. And he had a small chapel there built. It was one of the bell towers that he wanted to live in himself, but he dedicated it to St. Michael at the time, and then he wanted to build a church called St. Michael's next to the clinic. He never was able to finish that. But what happened here is that his cures became amped up in power once he was working with God. His healings were becoming famous. and the people stayed healed. A lot of people loved him. He was just very well respected. And the other brujo became jealous. And he was upset because they no longer saw things the same way. Whereas normal in normal brujeria or a brujo, they'll see God and the devil as equals. One is the light, one is the dark. They use both sides when they think it's right to do so. There's no real dividing line there. And once Francisco gave his life to God, he renounced the devil and stepped away from him completely. At some point, the other brujo decided that this was just too much. Francisco was beginning to gain notoriety for healing AIDS, and he was healing AIDS holistically. And the other doctor just became so angry that he devised a plan to literally curse Francisco with AIDS, not just give him AIDS, but to curse him with AIDS. So it became a curse that eventually killed Francisco. Francisco was gay, and the other brujo sent this beautiful young boy and his brothers to work with Francisco and secretly gave the young man, the beautiful one, AIDS before he sent him over. And Francisco had an affair with this young man and loved him deeply, and the young man too. And then didn't realize, of course, that the young man had AIDS because he had just been given AIDS, so he didn't have any symptoms of it. And they both came down with AIDS, and Francisco couldn't heal him. He couldn't heal his lover, and he couldn't heal himself, and he couldn't understand why. He kept trying, you know, his different things that he was doing with other patients that were working, but they weren't working for him. And then somewhere around, you know, a few months or so, or maybe a year after he was given AIDS, he went in to see his sister at the consultorio. They had a clinic in town in Juarez as well, and found his sister literally up against the wall, like 3 feet off the floor, being pinned to the wall by a demon. In other words, by unseen hands. She was just pinned up against the wall. And he could tell immediately that she was possessed. Her eyes were rolled back in her head, and she was in a very unnatural posture. And he could not get her off the wall. He tried everything. He went back to his home, which was a fantastic mansion. He got his sword and everything that he had used in other exorcisms and tried to get her off, and he couldn't. So he called his sister Esperanza, who he named the clinic after, and had her send over the youngest nephew, who was able to pry her off. But it was at that point that he realized that the reason he couldn't cure himself was that he'd actually been cursed.
Wow.
Yeah. So he basically realized at that point that there was nothing he could do. There was nothing he could do for his family either, because her being possessed and up against the wall was a warning. So at that point, he realized that this was a curse. It was a heavy-duty curse, and that he was going to have to try to reverse the curse. But at that point, he was weak and he was sick. I'm sure he did everything he could. You know, I didn't know Francisco personally, but I can tell just by what his family had told me that he tried everything, but nothing worked. So he just resigned himself to die. And so he died in 1993, and the other brujo and his clan members or whatever, and of course some of the workers that worked there for Francisco at the clinic, that were still building the clinic, you know, the other brujo cursed the land. He cursed the clinic. He cursed the land. Francisco had a huge dog, mastiff, beautiful dog, very friendly, named Bruno. And the family came out one day and found him dead.
Oh, my.
Yeah, that they, you know, because, you know, brujos, very skilled brujos can live or act through animals and birds and things. And I'm sure the people were scared to death of this big mastiff, because you know, once Francisco died, I'm sure he probably wasn't quite as friendly, especially to the workers and some of the men or whatever, but they feared him, so they killed him. And then they buried him where the St. Michael's Church was going to be, right next to the foundation. They buried him there, and then within a couple of days, they came back and they found graveyard dirt and this huge 6-foot cross that was molded like 4x4, you know, the stanchions and the pole. So this huge cement cross, 6 foot, over 6 foot, Jim, is gigantic. It was very, very heavy, or maybe almost 300 pounds, was laying on top of the dog's grave with graveyard dirt on there. So they cursed they even cursed the grave. They were so scared of this dog and so scared of Francisco's spirit using the dog that they made sure that they cursed the dog, and they put this huge graveyard cross on. They had to drag this cross 5 miles over these rough prairie roads from the highway to the spot. So talk about determination. These guys were full of it. But anyway, then the water at that point, too, the underground aquifer, the land moved underneath the clinic because it was cursed, and the water stopped flowing. And now this water was not just important for the clinic itself, which had a formal-sized swimming pool and saunas and everything, but it also irrigated the crops on the land where it was at. So for the water to stop running literally put the entire farm that belonged to Francisco's oldest sister, Esperanza, and her husband, Jorge, in jeopardy. They had to buy water to irrigate after that. They couldn't use their own. And so it was starting to just bring the entire family down. But also the family members themselves, many of them got sick. Jorge developed asthma. He couldn't even live on the rancho anymore. His younger son, Miguel, took over the farming. He and his wife and Jorge and Esperanza moved to Juarez. So there were illnesses. There were financial problems. The land was deteriorating. The clinic was deteriorating. They tried using it as a restaurant, but the place was just so haunted. And plus, it was 5 miles out on these prairie roads. Francisco had intended to build a nice road from the highway out there, but it never was finished. It was never done. So trying to get people even to there was almost impossible. The thing is, the clinic, as the bird flies, was only a mile or so from Viejo Mata, but there were no roads. You had to go all the way around the highway west of Viejo Mata and clear around and then come in from the west side. So it was quite daunting, actually, to get to that clinic.
Now, what was one of the most terrifying confrontations you had when you were trying to clear this place and try to help these folks?
There were quite a few, actually. There were, in the entire book, there's five major confrontations, but one of the worst was the first night when we got there and we had to actually try to clear it enough to where we could actually go in the next day and work. And as we began the clearing, we were clearing each room in turn, starting with the east side. And there was one of the doors were locked, and Todd, the minister that I was with, Todd Berg, Maria Teresa and Gloria, Francisco's sister, the doctor, the one that had been up against the wall, literally had to go out, leave me in the hallway by myself, and go out and around and try to get that door open. And they could not get the door open. It had old-fashioned lock and one of those old metal keys that, you know, the old turn-type key. And they couldn't find it. But in the meantime, I was standing out there with this very small candle. We didn't realize we couldn't turn the lights on until Miguel told us that he actually had to go into the building by himself to get to the panel to turn it on. And we had already disrupted a few things at that point, we'd already done some work. So I knew that the spirits in there were going to be really upset. And I didn't want Miguel to go in there and try to turn those lights on. So we went in. We had these really small candles, a little bit of sage, and holy water from Fatima. I was standing there by myself, and my candles started. All these demons were these spirits. Some weren't demons; some were just, you know, nature spirits and all this. But they were really upset, and they were just pressing in on me. And there were thousands, and I could see them. Normally, I can't see spirits, but I could see these guys, and they were just like right in my face. And my candle started to gutter, my sage started to go out, and I'm standing there praying the Lord's Prayer and calling on Saint Michael, and my prayers got louder and louder and louder, and Todd heard him from the other room, and he's like desperately trying to get through to me, and he couldn't, and he had to run back around and dash through, and like an avenging angel jumped to my defense, and at the same time Saint Michael showed up, and they all just backed way off, and it was quite the experience.
I guess it was. I want to ask you about another experience. You had sent along some stories that you're working on for another project, and certainly I want you to tell people where you'll find this book and information on this book. But I wanted to ask you about one of the stories in there that you sent us in that batch. We've done shows in the past with Rosemary Ellen Guiley about the djinn, and it sounds like you had an experience with a djinn who lived in an upstairs closet. Could you tell us a little bit about that? Because I'm fascinated and terrified by the djinn.
Well, with good reason, I think. Yeah, that was an interesting one. I had helped this couple previously in their other apartment to back off some demonic problems and gotten them clear of that. And they decided they were going to move and find another place to live, which was a really good idea. And they found this other apartment. And the wife called me up and she said, could you come over? She said, I think there's a spirit living in this apartment. And anyway, I said, yeah, you know, I'll be right over. And before I even left the house, I knew it was a djinn. And that's part of being a charismatic. God just always lets me know what the deal is. And I just thought, that's a djinn. That's not demonic. That's not some kind of nasty other type of spirit. And, you know, the one thing about djinn is that they like gemstones. They like shiny things. They like things that they can absorb or pull the luster of and own it. And so my husband and I had collected stones for years. I've been a rock hound for years, but I had gotten a chance to pick up some faceted stones that I bought from overseas. And so I went in and I found a really large fluorite. It was probably maybe 5 to 7 carat fluorite. And I wanted something natural that was also cut that would, you know, shine, that would give off this luster. And I took it over to the apartment. And as I went through the apartment, I knew exactly he was in the upstairs closet. So I took the stone and I put the stone on this little shelf in the closet. It was still empty. They hadn't moved anything in. And I put it there and I basically addressed the djinn and I said, here, you can have the stone. You can have the luster from the stone. You can keep that, you know, but please leave. This is for you. Please leave this residence. And I left a candle of St. Michael burning in the closet. It was protected, so it wouldn't cause a fire, but there was nothing in there anyway. I just left it burning, and I left the door open to the closet. So I could immediately sense the djinn covering the stone. It just leaped forward, and it absorbed the luster of the stone. But then it followed me downstairs. And so as I cleared the bottom, I went through with exercised oil and salt. I did not salt the closet because salt really annoys djinn, but I did use oil in the closet. I went and cleared all the rest of the rooms and downstairs. As I began clearing the rooms downstairs, there was one little spot there underneath the stairway where there was a storage area. And you know, I have very good peripheral vision. And I went down and I knelt underneath the stairway there. And there, it was a fairly large little area. And so I cleared that out and I salted and everything. And just as I was backing out of that area, I felt myself just get lifted and slammed. He slammed the back of my head against the little door sill, the top of the door opening, and just bang, you know, really hit me pretty good. And I knew it was him. He didn't want to leave, but he was going to leave. He just was mad about it. So anyway, I finished, kind of staggered around for a minute or two, but I finished. And when my husband and I left that day, the djinn left with us. So we get in our car and we're driving down. We're a couple blocks away as a Staples. My husband needs to stop and pick up some stuff. And we, as we, before we even got to the Staples, we were just at each other's throats. You know, we've been married 36 years and we normally don't argue, but we were just like yelling at each other. And this was within a block or so of the house where we'd been at the apartment. And all of a sudden, I'd looked at Tim and he looked at me and he said, "He's in the car, isn't he?" I said, "Yeah, he's in the car." And I grabbed the spray bottle of salt water and we just rolled all the, you know, we just hit the electrics and rolled the windows down. And I just grabbed the spray bottle and just sprayed the heck out of the inside of the car and commanded him to leave. And he did. And of course, we didn't even know what we were arguing about at that point. And we drove into Staples, but once we did, I went in and I salted the car and used oil on the car and blessed the car and everything else and ourselves and stuff before Tim and I got back in the car to leave. And that was the last we heard of him, and he did not return to the apartment. And I told the family, I said, "Leave that stone there for 7 days. I said, after that, you can take it, clear it, and you can keep the stone and buy a setting or do whatever you want with it. But you have to leave it there for 7 days," and they did. So, yeah, he was really mad. He was very, very upset, that djinn.
Well, we've not been upset at all. We've had a good time, very interesting discussion with Sonia. Sonia, where can people find more information? I know you have a website, and where can they find the book that we discussed, The Curse of El Diablo?
Well, the website is getridofghosts.com, just GETRIDOFGHOSTS, getridofghosts.com or .org. And the book is, I mentioned it right on the front page. You can get a signed copy from me if you want, or you can find it at glanettie.com, which is my publisher, and or Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever. It's in soft cover and in Kindle. And it is an exciting read, because everything that's in that book is true. We had to fight for Francisco's soul. He was still there. Francisco did not leave. He wanted to make sure that his family was freed. And literally, his body was gone, but the rest of him, his awareness, his power, his soul, his spirit, was there. So, you know, he fought alongside us, and it was an incredible experience. So I hope people enjoy the book, and the website has a huge amount of information on it, whether it's about exorcisms or whether it's about possession or oppression or whatever. And if people want any exorcised oil or salt, which is very difficult to get, actually, but mine is actually exorcised by a true diocese-approved exorcist. And I have other blessed items as well, rosaries and things. I don't sell anything. If you need salt and oil, or I'll send salt oil, I'll send you rosaries, I'll send you blessed metals that you can build a perimeter around your place. I send all that out for free. If you can donate for postage, if you can afford that, then fine. If you cannot, let me know. You know, God works it all out. We're self-funded, but, you know, there are some wonderful people that, you know, they contribute more, they just donate, and we can use that for the people that can't afford it. So it's this is what we do. We have an apostolate. I love what I do. So there's an email where they can email me on the contact me page or contact us page. You know, they can go from there. But please don't send me an email saying, call me, I want to tell you my story.
Leave that for the campfire.
I have no time for that. Write your story down when you send me the email. Tell me what the problem is. Believe me, I have a lot of clients, and there's only one of me, so I need to be able to address it quickly, help you quickly, send your name and address if you want a package of salt and oil and the blessed items. You know, there's lots of good links on there, and I just, if you have a question, put it in the email, send it to me.
All right. Well, Sonia Brose, thank you so much for joining us today on Ghost Insight.
Well, thank you, Jim. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for tuning in to Ghost Insight. We certainly appreciate it. We hope that you enjoyed today's show as we did, and we'll talk to you next time. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.